This week in 1809, the man considered the greatest American who ever lived was born.
Way down upon the Wabash, such land was never known.
If Adam had crossed over it, this soil he'd surely own.
200 years later, Abe Lincoln of Illinois still seems to embody America in its contradictions. A self-educated sodbuster and rail splitter who became renowned for silken rhetoric. The leader of a nation that was at once a beacon of liberty and a bastion for slavery. A man who said he hated war, then drove his country through the bloodiest war. Lincoln's face has come to be seen as the very portrait of America, rough, noble, sad, and strong. My mother used to call Abe Lincoln my father-in-law. She had to remember his birthday each year and make room for his picture among our family photos. My stepfather, Ralph Newman, owned the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago, which was a first stop for a lot of writers who wanted to learn about Lincoln, from Carl Sandburg to Doris Kearns Goodwin. But Ralph was a Lincoln lover, not a scholar. He used to enjoy reminding Lincoln worshippers that the man they so rightly revered for his silver tongue also loved to tell rude jokes about the mating apparatus of horses. Ralph also imitated Lincoln's signature, the vaulting A, the L, looping like a lariat. He enjoyed signing Lincoln's name in preposterous places like birthday cards or refrigerator notes, and once gave me a deli order on the back of an envelope. "I'll have the corned beef. Yours, A. Lincoln." Now, Ralph's Lincoln was salty, funny, and haunted. And on this 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth, and with the help of a few friends who will be voices from history, I'd like to point to some of the things Ralph did to remind people of Abe Lincoln before he became a marble statue.
Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago, many long years ago.
Abe Lincoln was the butt of a lot of jokes. At times he was a laughingstock. Lincoln lost as many elections as he won, and he won less than 40% of the vote to get elected president. Few men in public life have been as widely mocked. General George McClellan, the wildly popular commander of the Union Army, said,
"The president is an idiot, a prairie baboon, a bloodthirsty tyrant."
McClellan built the largest standing army in history, then shrank from sending the men who idolized him into battle. This exasperated Lincoln, who told his cabinet, "If General McClellan is not using his army, I would like to borrow it." McClellan told his wife in a letter, November 1861,
"I went to the White House shortly after tea, where I found the original gorilla about as intelligent as ever. What a specimen to be at the head of our affairs now."
McClellan would run against Lincoln in 1864 on a Democratic peace platform. Peace Democrats, sometimes called copperheads, were nominally against slavery, but they also thought it was part of the South's heritage. Anyhow, they didn't think it was worth a war to abolish it. Publisher Marcus M. Pomeroy of Wisconsin fulminated,
"Lincoln is but the fungus from the corrupt womb of bigotry and fanaticism, a worse tyrant and more inhumane butcher than has existed since the days of Nero. And if he is elected to misgovern for another 4 years, we trust some bold hand will pierce his heart with dagger point for the public good."
Which kind of makes Rush Limbaugh and Michael Moore seem tame. And do you think that Europeans have ridiculed only recent U.S. presidents? When Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1864, the Times of London denounced him as a brutal stooge.
"A foul-tongued, ribald punster, the most despicable tyrant of modern days, has now signed a document that will humiliate the Confederacy and make peace unfathomable. It is an avowed step towards the foundation of military despotism."
Now, Lincoln could reply sharply to his critics, but he was more noted for making himself the butt of his jokes, not because he necessarily bore malice toward none, but as Ralph, my stepfather, believed, because Lincoln had self-esteem to spare. He knew how to win at wrestling, as a boy, in the courtroom, as a grown man, and finally, politics. In 1864, Lincoln was informed by the War Department that five sons of Mrs. Lydia Bixby of Massachusetts had been killed in battle. In his own hand, he wrote her,
"I feel how weak and fruitless must be any word of mine which should attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. but I cannot refrain from tendering you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic they died to save.
When the fog of war lifted, it developed that only two Bixby sons had died in battle. Another two had deserted. One was a prisoner of war. Lincoln wrote their mother,
"I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost, and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Yours very sincerely and respectfully,
A. Lincoln." Turned out that Lydia Bixby was a copperhead. She abhorred Lincoln and told friends she had destroyed his letter. So how did it appear in the Boston Evening Transcript? How did so many lithographic copies get printed and passed around to attest to the president's solicitude and humanity? Well, my stepfather Ralph thought the answer was obvious. Lincoln made certain that the newspapers saw his letter to Lydia Bixby before Mrs. Bixby did. He pointed out that all of Lincoln's most famous handwritten letters were carefully composed to fill just a single page, ready to be framed and for mass reproduction. Lincoln was humble before God, not in politics. Lincoln was self-educated and really read only three works deeply: the King James Bible, the plays of Shakespeare, and the Illinois Criminal Code. They were the right ones. Ralph believed that Lincoln learned cadence and parables from King James, precedent, lawyer's parables from the law, and simile and paradox from Shakespeare. Churchill and Nehru are among a small number of other chiefs of state whose letters and speeches can also be read as literature. But Lincoln's most indelible speeches are remarkably reflective instead of oratorical. Even as he sought to inspire resolve, he confided doubts. In his famous second inaugural address, Lincoln spoke with remorse for both what the South had died to defend and what the North had done to win.
"Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with or even before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes."
Now imagine if there was live broadcast coverage today of Sherman's burning of Atlanta.
"We can see Union soldiers setting torches to all the warehouses, shops, and food stores. The railroad depot is in flames. People are hungry and shivering. Lost children wander the streets. This city is smoldering. General Sherman's men are marching out of Atlanta and leaving just ruins behind."
How would the American people react today to hearing Lincoln tell them, as he did in the second inaugural, that the suffering their army was inflicting on civilians and the loss of so many thousands of their own sons in battle was just atonement that America had to make for the sin of slavery?
"And until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether."
Lincoln's assassination, of course, was one of the great tragedies of history. But my stepfather, Ralph Newman, pointed out his death also freed Lincoln from mundane matters like Reconstruction, monetary policy, or going back home to Illinois to become a railroad lawyer again. Lincoln's murder made him a martyr of America's faith. And maybe we can say this, 144 years after his life ended, Lincoln's death made his life into a parable. It completed the poem. It was the last act of a drama that began with a boy born in a log cabin who wound up in the White House, and finally, a life cast in marble. Lincoln's death made him the last casualty of the war he had set loose, in which 500,000 people died to make a nation live up to its promise. The last costly sacrifice laid upon the altar of freedom was Abe Lincoln's own. Our voices from history included Peter Sagal, Ira Glass, Jamie Kumarasamy, Representative Jesse Jackson, Jr., and Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, Wolf Blitzer, and William Sapphire. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.